So, Srimad Bhagavatam, presented by Srila Prabhupada, 799, Prayers of Prahlada Maharaj. Manye,
Manye,
Dana,
Dana,
Abhijana,
Abhijana,
Rupa,
Rupa,
Tapa,
Tapa,
Shuta,
Shuta,
Ojas,
Ojas,
Tejas,
Tejas,
Prabhava,
Prabhava,
Bala,
Bala,
Purusha,
Purusha,
Udhi,
Udhi,
Yoga,
Yoga,
Nama,
Aradhanaya,
Aradhanaya,
Hi,
Bhavanti,
Bhavanti,
Parasya,
Parasya,
Pumsa,
Pumsa,
Bhaktya,
Bhaktya,
Tutosha,
Tutosha,
Prabhupada's translation. Prahlada Maharaj continued, one may possess wealth, an aristocratic family, beauty, austerity, education, sensory expertise, luster, influence, physical strength, diligence, intelligence, and mystic yoga power. But I think that even by all these qualifications, one cannot satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead. However, one can satisfy the Lord simply by devotional service. Gajendra did this, and thus the Lord was satisfied with him. Purport, no kind of material qualification is the means for satisfying the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, only by devotional service can the Lord be known. Bhaktya mam abhi janati. Unless the Lord is pleased by a devotee's service, the Lord does not reveal himself. Nam prakasha sarvasya yoga maya samavrita. This is the verdict of all shastras. Neither by speculation nor by material qualifications can one understand or approach the Supreme Personality of God. Soma Gyana Tanidam Vasyanam Janasan Salankara Chakshuram Nivitam Dina Tasmai Sri Guru Venama. Just a word that sometimes is translated as my eyes are opened by the torch light of knowledge. That's not actually what the Sanskrit says. Salaka, Gyananjana Salakaya. Anjana is an ointment that's placed on the eye to restore vision. And so Gyananjana by the ointment of knowledge, and then Shalakaya. Shalaka means like a little Q-tip, what do you call it? Like a little thing used to clean your ear.
Q-tip.
So that's a Q-tip, basically. And so it means that by applying with that little cotton thing, by applying the ointment of knowledge, the eye was opened. But in India, sometimes they call it like a flashlight, they call it torch in England, so somehow it came out torch-like, but actually that's what the word actually means. Not quite as dramatic in a sense, but that's what it means. Om Gyana Tamirandasya Gyanam Jana Shalakaya Shalakaya Chakshu Unmilitam. Unmilitam means opening the eye, Chakshu the eye, Chakshu Unmilitam Jaina, by whom Tasmaya to him, Sri Gurave Nama. So here, Prahlada Maharaj, as Prabhupada clearly explains, contrasts all kinds of material qualifications with simple devotion and concludes that it is devotion and not any material qualification by itself that can satisfy Krishna. So the list of material qualifications is interesting. Dana, wealth, It's interesting because in any society, even a spiritual society, you find this in all religions. Some people give large donations and at times gain a certain amount of influence within a spiritual society by giving donations. Or a spiritual society may sort of reinvent itself or adjust itself to be pleasing to those who do give large donations. And so these are issues that are real. Not always talked about, but there are challenges for a spiritual society. It's not that easy to be a spiritual society and actually remain spiritual. Lord Chaitanya gives the example in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that we are cultivating he calls the flowering creeper of bhakti lata, in the garden of the heart, but of course weeds also grow. And I think it's important to note the obvious, that weeds grow not only in the individual heart, but weeds grow in communities. Weeds can grow in a community, in a society. There are also social weeds. In other words, within a spiritual society, weeds can grow. And not simply in the individual. Because after all, society is just a bunch of people. And if you have a bunch of people who are getting a little weedy, then you're going to get a pretty weedy society. So we have to be very vigilant. That's why to have a culture where we're not allowed to note in general in ISKCON or any other society, if it's considered bad manners or rude or inappropriate or offensive to ever note that we're not exactly going in the right direction in some ways, if that's considered to be offensive or rude, then how do you weed the garden? It's an interesting question, things actually have to think about. So, dana, wealth, abhijana, aristocratic family. There are not many aristocratic families left, there's hardly any. Nowadays, if you get money and aristocracy have kind of merged in the modern age. But in India, people were very concerned, and also in Europe, I mean, everywhere in the world before the Industrial Revolution changed everything. People were very concerned. Your last name was extremely important. You know, in India, they call it Jati. In the West, if you ever watch old English movies, you know, like these 19th century stories, you can see them up till recently, even to some extent today, the English themselves were somewhat obsessed with family and rank and distinction and so on and so forth. And obviously other places in Europe as well. So in America, not so much. In America, if you have money, then you're an aristocrat. That's about the end of it. But in Europe, they have a little more of the old culture. So abhijana, that's what that means. Dana, abhijana, rupa, beauty. What did Jane Austen say, that if a woman is beautiful, if a young lady is beautiful and also friendly, a man will assume she has every other good qualification? So, beauty, tapa, austerity, sometimes it's kind of like, among some devotees, it's kind of like the austerity Olympics, to see who can fast more, or who can do without more, and somehow it's considered, it's like you kind of win trophies, like I fasted longer than you did or something. So you can see how austerity also can become, for some people, a mark of distinction. Then shuddha, education. Yes, we can certainly become proud of our education, and that is obviously another form of false ego. And then ojas, probably translates your sensory prowess, sort of your stamina, your vigor, vitality. Teja, probably says bodily effulgence. Teja, something like splendor or some type of fiery power. Prabhava, probably translates as influence. Prabhava, Yes, it can mean power, strength, one's influence over others. Bala, bodily strength. I just love a joke from myself. So bodily strength, people do become, you know, people, there's some men that want to look like the Terminator. And so that's another point, bodily strength. Buddhi, which of course we know what buddhi means, it probably translates it here, just intelligence. Being clever, and yoga, mystic power. So the verse says that all these qualifications, naradanayahi bhavanti, parasipamsa, literally they do not lead to, or they are not by themselves conducive to the worship, na aradhanaya, of the Supreme Person. Sometimes they can have the opposite effect. We become proud of our so-called qualifications, and therefore that pride leads us away from Krishna. So, what is that verse by Kunti?
Janmaishwarya.
What?
That Janmaishwarya.
Yeah, Janmaishwarya Sutta Sivir Idamana Vedat Puman Naivarahati Abhidhatam Vai Pam Lakinchita Gocha. So, Janmaishwarya Sutta Sivir. So, in contrast to all of these, bhaktiya, by devotion, tuntosha bhagavan, the Lord was satisfied. Gaja yutapaya, literally, satisfied unto, sort of a poetic way of speaking, he was satisfied unto, in the sense of satisfied with, the leader of the elephant community, yuta. Yuta means a herd or community. Gaja is elephant, so Gaja Yuta Pa, the leader of the elephant community, which of course refers to Gaja Indra, Gajendra, the Indra, the lord of the elephants. Gaja Yuta Paya. So by devotion, the Lord was satisfied. The idea here is that Gajendra, of course, was just an elephant, but he was a very intelligent elephant. He seemed to clearly have a mastery of language. And he offered very beautiful prayers to the Lord, so as smarter than the average elephant, obviously. But Gajendra offered wonderful prayers to Krishna, and then he's a symbol of how one can please the Lord and be saved by the Lord simply by one's devotion, because he really had nothing else going for him at the time. It's interesting, if you think about typical sort of ritualistic, brahminical idea, all kinds of ceremonies and offering all kinds of ceremonies and mantras. And in contrast, that Gajendra just held up a lotus flower and said, help. And then he prayed to Krishna. It's interesting how in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, the word Vedic, of course, can mean different things. Prabhupada, and we use the word Vedic to mean the entire civilization, which is described in the Vedic literature, broadly understood, including Bhagavatam, of course, and Bhagavad Gita. And that civilization we refer to as Vedic. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita and the Bhagavatam, the word Vedic is actually used more narrowly to refer to, in the CC, if you actually look it up, you can look this up in the database, the word Vedic in Sanskrit is Vaidik, Vaidika. And so the word Vedic, that adjective is used almost, perhaps I think exclusively in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, in the phrase of Vaidika Brahmana. A Vedic Brahman, of course, in the sense of a ritualistic Brahman, Karmakanda. And that's actually how the word is used in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. In the Bhagavatam, the word is used in a somewhat similar way. The word Vaidika, Vedic, is used in the Bhagavatam always in contrast with Tantrika, Tantra, the Sanskrit word, the Sanskrit verb tan means to expand or to extend, as in the first verse of the Bhagavatam, Tene Brahma Hrida, the Lord extended the Vedic knowledge to Brahma, to his heart. So, also, for example, one's expansion, the sense of one's child, is called tanu. Or actually, tanu means the body. And then the child is called tanuja, one born from one's body. So, as in Ayananda Tanuja in the Shikshastika. So, anyway, that's the word tan. And so from the word tan, you have tantra. Tra has a sense of instrument, of accomplishing something. So tantra means in this case, a supplementary text which expands or extends the knowledge of the Vedas. And so the sort of the quintessential tantra is a Narada Pancharatra. Therefore, in the list of incarnations, in the third canto of the Bhagavatam, first canto, third chapter of the Bhagavatam, Narada is included in the list of avatars because it said tantram satvatam achastra. He taught a Vaishnava tantra, which is a Narada Pancharatra. So, it is in tantra literature, and literature like the Bhagavatam, which combines both the original Vedas and the tantra, that we find, for example, knowledge of deity worship, knowledge of the deities, knowledge of the spiritual world, knowledge of the expansions of Krishna, such as Vasudeva Narayan. All that we don't find in the four Vedas, and we hardly find in the Upanishads, but it is found in the tantra literature. This is not to be confused with the sort of degraded tantra later. That's a different thing. This is the original tantra. And so in the Bhagavatam, the word Vedic is used mostly to distinguish between Vaidika and Tantrika, knowledge which comes from the Shruti, the original Shruti literature, and then knowledge which comes from Tantrika literature, such as the Narada Pancharatra and other books, even the Bhagavatam itself, so which has both. So that's how the word Vedic is used in Shastra. And the term that we use, Prabhupada used, and we use all the time, all of us use this term, Vedic culture. It's interesting that this exact term is not actually found in Shastra. And there are some words that are found in Shastra, such as nature, prakriti. I mean, much of the translation, when you translate from Sanskrit to English, a lot of the words are a direct literal translation. Nature, God, the soul, and so on. Person. But when we translate Vedic culture, it's not actually a translation of any literal word in Shastra. And yet we use it all the time. So this is interesting that we use constantly a term which in fact is not literally found in Shastra. So, it doesn't mean the concept is not there. It doesn't mean the term is wrong. It's a simple hermeneutic principle. If we want to be reasonable in our explanation of Vedic culture, if we have a term which is not in Shastra, literally, then we have to explain the term from Shastra. We can't give a non-Shastric definition to a non-Shastric term. Because if you have a non-Shastric term and a non-Shastric definition, what is the authority for it? So therefore, how can we define Vedic culture in a way that is found in Shastra, since the term itself is not? And we could talk, as we discussed yesterday, we could talk about Varnashram. Varnashram is very much part of Vedic civilization. It's in the Vedas, it's in the Rig Veda, it's in the Bhagavad Gita, so it's very much part of our culture. I suggest that we should be a little more careful than some people are in what we describe as being Vedic culture. Because if we say that something is Vedic culture, but that thing is not in Shastra, then in what sense is it Vedic culture? So here we have to make a clear distinction between cultural principles such as Varnashram, such as Krishna Bhakti, such as Parampara. These are all cultural principles. On the other hand, we should not confuse these things with ethnic details. An ethnic, for example, in different parts of the world, they have different recipes for cooking. Or people have different dress styles or different music styles or different forms of architecture. And we know from history, if we care to look at history, that these things change. They change over time, they change in different regions, they change among different parts. If you take India, for example, just take India, the time of Krishna. There, to start off with, there are four varnas and four ashrams. So already you've got eight variables. If you know math at all, that's a lot of variables. Not only do you have eight variables of varna and ashram, which are different, but you have different climates. Cold places, warm places, moderate places. There is culture found in mountains, in jungles, in deserts, in forests, in wilderness, in farm communities and villages and big cities and medium-sized towns. And actually, you find differences. The authority for this comes from the gopis themselves. The gopis always say that now that Krishna left a little dairy village and he went to a big city, big political capital, Mathura, that he'll have a different culture. His taste in women will change. He'll be a different person. In fact, Krishna didn't dress differently when he went to the big city. He dressed like a prince. Princes didn't dress like cowboy boys. They still don't. So, there are many, many variables, and we have talked about different yugas and different times and different regions of India. For example, South Indian temple architecture is very different from North Indian temple architecture. And still different is Himalayan architecture. If you look at temples in the Himalayan mountains, they're very different from North or South India. Food is different. For example, in South India, they eat rice more. In North India, they eat more wheat. And they have many different recipes and regional dress styles. They have different forms of dance. They have different forms of music, etc., etc. So really, we're talking about hundreds of variables and many, many different cultural manifestations. We have to give an example of a regional cultural difference. In the Mahabharata, when Bhishma went to the kingdom of Madra, which is not the old Madras, this was in sort of modern-day northern Pakistan, when he went to the kingdom of Madra to request Madri as a bride for Pandu, her brother, Shalya, who of course appears later in the Mahabharata, said that in our kingdom we have a special cultural tradition, and that is we don't give dowries, we accept dowries, because they were a very proud family. So Bhishma didn't say that's not Vedic culture. He just gave the dowry. He paid up. And they took Madri away. And so there are many different customs. Another point is that when we read descriptions in Shastra, we have to be very careful not to confuse description with prescription. To prescribe something means to say you must do this. A prescription. A description just says that's what was going on. For example, Swayamvaras. If you look at Swayamvaras, you can find in different periods in history, Swayamvaras were done differently. In the older generation, we see that it really was a Swayamvara. Swayamvara means one's own choice. The idea being that I suppose the princess could choose her husband. And we find that that was the system. And when Pandu went to claim Kunti, when Pandu went to Kunti's Swayamvara, he actually, she chose him. And that was the end of it. Whereas in later Swayamvaras, as the world's moving toward Kali Yuga, in fact, the girl doesn't get a choice at all. Even Bhishma, for example, when he goes to the Swayamvara of the three princesses of Kashi, they have no choice at all. He just takes them. So how is it a Swayamvara? Swayam means personal, one's own, and Vara is choice. So how did the girls get any choice when Bhishma just took them away? And of course, in doing so, he, especially the old one, Amba, he basically destroyed her life and ultimately it cost him his life. So, and we hear in the 10th canto of Bhagavatam, only Swayamvara is where the girl chooses someone, but then the bride or the groom has to fight his way out of the ceremony. And so how is it a Swayamvara? So is the Bhagavatam saying this is the way things should be? Or is it simply saying that's the way it was 5,000 years ago when demons came to the earth, and when demons came to the earth, and culture was degraded. So what is the, as far as what we should do? For example, Shukadeva Goswami says, when Parikshit asks him why did Krishna engage in the rasa dance, why did he dance with other people's wives? If Krishna came to set an example. And Shukadeva answered that you cannot imitate what great souls do unless they tell you to do it. If a great soul does something and does not tell you to do it, then you shouldn't do it. Some people say we should dress like Krishna, but Krishna never actually told us to do that. So, in any case, there is that distinction. The Bhagavatam is describing, in Krishna Lila, the earth, when according to Bhagavad Gita, Dharma has been lost. What does Krishna say? That Sakali Neha Mahata Yoga Nasta, the spiritual science has been lost. So if you just look at the society described in the Bhagavatam and Mahabharata during Krishna's appearance around that time, Krishna himself describes it as a fallen society. He says, yoga nasta, spiritual science has been lost. He then says, yada yada hi dharma sivvani bhakti vart, whenever dharma is collapsing and adharma is rising, then I come, and Krishna just came. So that means the so-called Vedic society described at the time of Krishna is a fallen society in which the spiritual science has been lost and dharma has collapsed. And yet some people take that as a model. We have to do everything the way they did back then. Again, it requires some intelligence to understand the term Vedic culture. It actually requires some intelligence. So that's the other side of it. I mean, we cannot worship Krishna merely by intelligence, but if we do worship Krishna sincerely, then it's better to do so intelligently. As Krishna says in chapter 12 of the Gita, where he says, Mayi Buddhi Nivesha, the same word Buddhi, he says, Mayi Buddhi Nivesha, dedicate your intelligence to me. And in the Gita 10.10, Krishna says, Tesham Satata Yukta Nam Bhajadam Priti Burukam Dadami Buddhi Yogam Tam Jinamamu Pajanti Te. I give Buddhi Yoga. I give practical spiritual intelligence by which the devoted come to me. It's very interesting because Krishna always says in the Gita that you come to me by devotion. But at 10.10 he says, people, devotees come to me when they receive from me practical spiritual intelligence. So, it is a great science, Bhakti Yoga, and it really requires an open mind and a brain that's turned on and not turned off. To really understand Bhakti Yoga, one has to be not just memorize the philosophy and a few simple slogans. That's good. If that's all someone can do, then that's much better than nothing. But if possible, we actually have to think seriously about these things so that we present to the public an intelligent version of Krishna consciousness and not a dogmatic or fanatical version. Most people nowadays are allergic to fanaticism and dogmatism. We actually have to reason with people, and we have to have a reasonable understanding of our own philosophy and culture. So, any question on these points? Yes.
So how does one gain such a deep understanding of how the culture should actually be implemented and how it should be presented?
Well, one can study with or hear from people who have some understanding of these things. There is information out there. There are different human types. For example, if you take 1,000 human beings or 5,000 human beings, enough so that you get a sort of a complete sense, there's just a certain percentage of them who will be fanatics. Whether it's a religious society, whether it's an academic community, a certain percentage of scientists are fanatics, isn't it? Materialistic fanatics, it's just a certain percentage of them. A certain percentage of Christians, of Jews, of Muslims, of Buddhists, and a certain percentage of Hare Krishnas, to be honest, just have that psychological type. It would be absurd to say that if you look at the millions and millions of people who, in some way or other, accept Prabhupada, that none of them have that psychological type. And that would be rather absurd. So there are fanatical views. There are chauvinistic views. Chauvinism means making extreme and irrational claims for, you know, that we're better than other people. I mean, Krishna is God. Krishna is God, and Prabhupada is his pure devotee. So these things, Krishna, Prabhupada, Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavatam, these things are objectively superior. But at the same time, much of what we teach is also found in other places. We are, as a Lord Krishna, to understand Krishna as presented by Prabhupada is something very special. It's a special gift that we have. So we do have knowledge which is really not found elsewhere. And that knowledge is most important. And we do have a spiritual process that is practiced intelligently. We do have a spiritual process which is most powerful. It doesn't mean that we are completely free of hypocrites and fanatics. We know society is completely free of hypocrites and fanatics. But we do have that knowledge, and we do have that process. At the same time, so many things, like, for example, the principle of karma, the idea that there's a personal God, we're not our body. All these things, I mean, many people know that. Many people outside the Hare Krishna movement know that. Again, we do have, ultimately, special knowledge, which distinguishes the Gaudiya Vaishnavas. But if you think of knowledge as a pyramid, if you think of knowledge as a pyramid, at the lower levels of the pyramid, especially at the base, there's a lot of people that know some of the things we teach, and then as the knowledge becomes more advanced, perhaps there's fewer people. And ultimately, Lord Chaitanya gave a unique understanding in terms of the highest knowledge. But we have to present a pure spiritual science, free of superstition, free of mythology. For example, yesterday we were back at our hotel and I handed Chandrasekhar back, I gave him back a little knife he gave me to cut some prasadam. And then he was sort of laughing. He said that, oh yeah, one ISKCON sannyasi years ago told him that in India that's, you know, some kind of inauspicious thing. And we really should not fill up our lives with all kinds of superstitions and this and everything. But we should really try to just focus on a pure spiritual science. And we should try to understand the term Vedic culture in a way which is actually consistent with Shastra. As far as I read Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, there seems to be very, very little concern with telling people what kind of architecture they should use, what music style they should use, how they should dress, exactly what recipes they should cook with. There seems to be very little of that. And of course, it should be in the mode of goodness and then offered to Krishna. That's the principle. That's actually what Krishna teaches. Krishna, in the Bhagavad Gita, does not teach an ethnic tradition. He does not teach an ethnic tradition. He teaches a pure spiritual science which consists of living in the mode of goodness and offering your life to Krishna. When you offer sattva to Krishna, it becomes shuddha sattva, spiritual. So I think the more we can just teach that pure spiritual science and skip the superstitions and the heavy ethnic requirements, the more people will actually be able to accept it. I see our job as trying to facilitate people, not make it more difficult for them. If we just pile rules on rules on rules and this thing and that thing and the other thing, apart from obviously the basic principles we have, why make it more difficult for people? As we already know, it's already difficult. I mean, it's difficult for us. Lord Chaitanya is very merciful. He's simplified the process. He's made it as easy as possible. And that's why we're here. But anyone who's been around for a while knows it's not the easiest thing in the world to become a pure devotee. It's not so easy to think of Krishna all the time. It's not so easy to go back to Godhead. It requires real effort. It's already not easy. So why make it more difficult? Why add all kinds of unnecessary requirements when we see that people are not able to do it? It's like if you're a music teacher, if you sit down with your student at the keyboard and say, play this, and you see the student just can't do it, you give them an easier thing to do. And you keep doing that. That's what a teacher does. You find the student's level. That's the first thing a teacher does, is you have to find out what is the level of the student. What can the student actually do? For example, I was helping one devotee who went back to college, and this devotee reported me that he took one class online degree program in America, and the teacher was teaching a class for the first time, and he was just out of control. You know, it's like assigning books that none of the students could understand, and all these. And so all the students start complaining, we can't do this. This is too much. And so the teacher, you know, it's his first course, he didn't know what he was doing. So he tried to adjust it, but that's what it means to be a good teacher. Prabhupada gave us a very simple assignment. Whatever country we live in, we have to spread Krishna consciousness in a powerful way. And if we see that it's a little difficult for people, it is our responsibility. Again, the head has to figure out how to connect to the body. Headless bodies don't figure anything out. Headless bodies don't think. It's not the public, it's not that all of Denmark people are staying up at night trying to figure out how they can join the Hare Krishna movement. That's not happening. It's our responsibility, because we are the ones who know. They don't know, but we do. And therefore it's our responsibility to find a way to make the people of Denmark comfortable with the Hare Krishna movement. We have to present ourselves in such a way that people can identify with us. Because if people don't identify with us, it's over. Game over. And so we see all over the Western world, not only in Denmark, but basically everywhere in the Western world, is that the public in general does not identify with us. The public in general does not consider us to be normal. And in America, for example, if the truth can be spoken, if we're allowed to speak the truth, in America, are some exceptional programs or some really great devotees preaching, but in general, nope. And that's the same I found all over the West, all over Western Europe, certainly all over America. It's just, so are we really oceans of mercy, or do we give ourselves an exemption? Like, I don't have to be an ocean of mercy, because great devotees, when it says Vancha Kalpa Tarubhyas Cha, etc., that's not for us, that's for great devotees. So therefore, we do not have the responsibility of being very merciful. Sometimes saying, I'm not on that platform, I'm not so advanced, I'm a fallen soul, is a very convenient way of freeing yourself from any real responsibility to actually get the job done. It doesn't say the great devotees, it doesn't say the acharyas, it just says Vaishnavas. And actually, in our dealings with each other and with the public, we often refer to ourselves as Vaishnavas. And this verse simply says Vaishnava, Vaishnavas. So, it would be wonderful to see a Hare Krishna movement in the Western world and to actually see intelligent, sincere devotees just, how should I put it, just relentlessly, desperately trying to find some practical way to reach people. You know, when we go out in public, how can we present ourselves so that people really feel comfortable with us? How can we, what kind of programs can we create where people really are just, it's as easy as possible for them. We don't compromise, we don't change our philosophy, we don't change our principles, but we make things as comfortable and as easy as humanly possible. Is that actually what the Hare Krishna movement does? That's a good question. I'm not going to presume to answer, but I would say it's something we should think about. If someone, if an outsider, you know, just the, I don't know, the anthropologist from Mars or something, if someone just came down and looked at the Hare Krishna movement in the Western world, would that person write up in his report, if Martians write, he might just, by telepathy, communicate it back to Mars, but in that person's report, would that person say, I've never seen a group of people more anxious, more determined, more eager to try to help people and do whatever it takes to reach them. I've never seen a group of people so flexible, so willing to present themselves in whatever way necessary within their principles so that people feel at ease with us, people can identify with us, people feel solidarity with us, they feel like we're one of them. And it's a group of people who are incredibly motivated to make people feel comfortable with them. Anyway, you can think about that yourself and draw your own conclusions about the Hare Krishna movement in the Western world. Yes?
The analogy you just used about the teacher wanting to give a specific, you know, whatever level of difficulty in terms of playing the piano, and the student not being able to play, and so lowering the, you know, the bar, so to speak, so to put, implies that ideally, though, if the student had the capacity, or he should, you know, reach that coveted ideal.
You know, I get your point.
So, like, it's not a good analogy, because it's kind of implying that well, let's compromise for the non-devotee, but if...
Okay, I will add something here to satisfy you and to make the analogy clear. And that is, when you take music lessons, any good music teacher will respect the freedom of the student, as the student advances, to choose their own style of music. I'm just starting to get into it. So, for example, in classical music, I personally am stuck in the Baroque. I really like Baroque music. I play music, you know, Bach or Handel or just general Baroque music. Then there's early classical, Haydn, and then you get Mozart, and of course there's Beethoven, and then it just, you know, you get all these, you know, romantic stuff and everything. But I like Baroque. So, it's interesting, when I was... A couple of years ago, I was in a place called University Glen in California, a beautiful little college community in the mountains, outside, about an hour outside of Los Angeles. I was writing for Prabhupada, And I, to sort of, and so my recreation, because Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, we should have recreation in moderation. Because Krishna actually says, yuktahara viharasya. Vihara means having fun, recreation, as in Braja Vihari. And Krishna says, moderate in eating, moderate in recreation. That's actually Krishna, as in author of Bhagavad Gita. So, I thought, okay, because I, for just to relax, I played this sort of sacred music on the keyboard just to, I don't know, recover from the effects of being the leader of a religious society. So there was a, I saw one day, I was just walking around this village and I saw a little ad, sort of, you know, that people put on telephone poles or something. And this guy offered piano lessons. He was a music professor at some nearby college and he was offering. So I said, okay, I'll try it. So I went there and the first day he was like, I mean, I didn't go back, yeah, it was just impossible, but because I told him I like Baroque music, he said, oh, you like Baroque? And I mean, it was pathetic because Baroque is, actually large numbers of people like Baroque, but he was kind of, yeah, just sort of small-minded, and so I would never, I didn't consider going back to this person. So when you take music lessons, a good teacher will respect, for example, some people like blues, jazz, pop, you know, all the various forms of classical music and so on. And so it's both level of difficulty, like you see piano books, they'll be like, you know, beginners, intermediate, advanced, and so on. So it's a question of giving the student the right level and also encouraging the student to pursue his or her own musical inclinations, assuming they're decent. So, there, now we've cleaned up the analogy.
Yeah, because we hear this so much in this kind of, you know, when and if someone becomes sincere, then, you know, they'll, well, to use the example of clothes, they'll, you know, put on the dhoti and the sari as a sign of their coming to the coveted platform. And so, it's like, I mean, you hear that all the time, you know, that you know, let's compromise as a halfway, as a bridge. You know, and try to trick them temporarily so that they can become comfortable with us. But, you know, in fine print, one day, sooner or later, we'll, you know, take him to the quote-unquote ideal platform.
I take seriously Prabhupada's books, as I'm sure we all do. And in one of Prabhupada's most important books, Nectar of Devotion, in Chapter 6, Rupa Goswami gives a list of the basic principles of Bhakti Yoga. And Prabhupada and Rupa Goswami make very clear that there are basic principles that you must follow if you become advanced. And there are details which are not so important and which are variable. Interestingly, he characterizes Hari Bhakti Vilas as basically variable details. But also, so Rupa Goswami gives a list. And I think that if someone claims that a particular devotional activity or a particular way of doing anything is a basic principle, I think you should first find it in the list. I mean, maybe people that talk that way are perhaps more intelligent than Rupa Goswami, which would be quite surprising. But Rupa Goswami does give a list. And so if a particular item, like you have to dress like this, if it's not in that list, then I don't know anybody personally that's more intelligent than Rupa Goswami. So either it's in the list or it's not on the list. And let's say if it's not on the list, then it must be in Shastra. If something is really important for devotional service, how could the Bhagavatam not mention something that's really important for devotional service? How could Rupa Goswami not mention it? Why would Prabhupada say so many times, and he says it so many times, that those things are not so important? So we don't have guru, sadhu, or shastra. And yet some people claim that it's very important, even though it's not in guru, sadhu, or shastra. Someone could say, well, Prabhupada said this or that, but then there's a large number of statements Prabhupada made saying exactly the opposite. So we don't have a clearance, there's no clear requirement. For example, Prabhupada says you're not the body. When does Prabhupada say you are the body? Prabhupada says that Krishna is the original form of God. When does Prabhupada ever say Krishna is not the original form of God? So if anything is really a basic principle of knowledge, Prabhupada teaches it, he doesn't teach the opposite. When you find cases, and there are cases, where Prabhupada says various things on the same topic, obviously we're not dealing with a basic principle. This is not rocket science. We're obviously not dealing with a basic principle. We're dealing with a variable principle. Otherwise, why would Prabhupada give variable and varying instructions on it? So, for me, it's just so simple. So if someone has the presumption, if someone, and apparently there are many people who do have this presumption, to declare and try to enforce a principle as a basic principle of bhakti yoga, which is not a basic principle for Rupa Goswami, it's not a basic principle for Shastra, and yet, so on what grounds do we declare it to be a basic principle? Personally, when I joined the Hare Krishna movement, what inspired me, well, first of all, what inspired me is Prabhupada and Krishna, but what really kept me going, what really thrilled me when I was a new devotee, is the idea of a spiritual science. The idea that I had transcended sectarian, fanatical religions, irrational, dogmatic religions. I had actually discovered a spiritual science. That's why I'm doing this. So I'm not about to let someone take that away from me and say, forget the spiritual science, wouldn't you rather have a dogmatic religion? So I take the principle of Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra very seriously. I take it very seriously. It seems like a little more seriously than some people. It's quite ironic because on superficial, nothing little things like dress, people can get very excited. But then you see all the devotees going to Vrindavan and sitting at the feet of great storytellers, in Vrindavan, and hearing all these pastimes and stories, and no one ever asks, where does it come from? One time a senior ISKCON sannyasi was taking me around Govardhan, and it's like every 10 steps there was some new lila to tell. Like here, Krishna stole Radharani's credit cards, or there's all kinds of things. It's like, every minute, here this happened, here that happened. And so at a certain point, I just stopped and I said, where do these stories come from? I mean, what's the authority for all these stories? And he stopped and he was startled and he said to me, no one ever asked me that. No one ever asked me that. So it's this very selective fidelity. For example, Krishna, as we know from Shastra, really likes yellow clothes. It's his favorite color. It's like those little things, what's your favorite color? So for Krishna, his favorite color for dressing is yellow. And yet, if you look at deities around the world, in Gaudiya Vaishnava centers, almost all the time, Krishna's not wearing yellow. Sometimes he's dressed like a Muslim prince. So everything is okay. So it's not really about Shastra. It's really, it just has to be within a certain tradition coming from India. So again, this selective enforcement of Shastra or skipping Shastra. In other words, if you like something, it's okay even if it's not in Shastra. And if you don't like it, it's bad. Even Shastra doesn't say it's bad. Personally, I think that we need to clean this up. I think we need a real spiritual science. I think people in Europe, in Western Europe, there's not a snowball's chance in hell that the people of Western Europe are going to be culturally colonized by South Asia. It's really not going to happen. And if someone thinks it's going to happen, I think, I will help pay for treatment for that person, so they can eventually. Anyway, so I mean, to think that Western Europe, especially nowadays, more than ever, that Western Europe can be culturally colonized. But what Western Europe will accept, in my view, is a real spiritual science. A real spiritual science presented by a pure devotee of Krishna. So therefore, my hope is that we can present a simple spiritual science, not a huge ethnic tradition, but a spiritual science, the science of Krishna. And if you look at, and there's many, 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 many statements from Prabhupada to this effect, this is not my imagination. Just like, for example, in Denmark, if there's some new discovery in medical science and computer science, it's immediately accepted. Because it's science. Isn't it? I mean, Denmark is an up-to-date first world country. So, if we present a real spiritual science, I think that's what we need to do. Well, first of all, we need to understand what that means. Yes?
The most important point is the when a person sees the purity of the character, right? I want to just...
Okay, go ahead.
Anywhere, a common man who is sincere, then how he is dressed will never be an obstacle to come to Krishna consciousness.
I think we are living on some other planet. We're not on this one. Because in the real world, all of social science, all of history tells us the opposite. People are superficial nowadays. They're superficial and they absolutely judge other people by their appearance. They absolutely do that. And I've heard from hundreds and hundreds of Western, I've heard from hundreds of devotees that this external thing kept me away from ISKCON. I've heard from, because you see, I'm kind of like the poster boy for this whole Western preaching. And so people don't want to go to their local Hare Krishna leader and be chastised and humiliated because they feel that way. But they will talk to me, and they do talk to me in very, very large numbers. And actually, I'll even show you from Shastra how what you said is, I mean, just taught me, don't mean to attack you, but I will even show you from Shastra why that's not true. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that in order to practice bhakti yoga, you have to be moderate and not extreme in the way you deal with your human needs. You don't eat too much, you don't eat too little. You don't sleep too much, you don't sleep... And then Krishna says, etc. In all activities. We not only have physical needs, we have emotional needs. And it is a basic human emotional need not to be humiliated, not to be considered an outcast in society. That is a basic human need as much as eating or sleeping. And when we raise the bar so high that if you want to really be a first-class member of ISKCON, you have to basically commit social suicide. You have to humiliate yourself in front of your friends, your family, your co-workers. This is real. You know, we can tell ourselves stories about what's important, not important. But when you go out into the real world and start talking to all the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of devotees in Western Europe, who were driven away from this movement by certain external things, or just couldn't take it anymore. And when they hear from me, they want to come back. They have a new hope. This is real. It's like if you say in the temple, you're not your body, so we're just going to feed you, you know, 7 chickpeas every day. You're not your body. And if you're really sincere, that won't bother you. So if you push people to physical or emotional extremes, most people will not take to Krishna consciousness. And that's what we do. We push people to extremes of emotional deprivation. Because most people, in fact, emotionally, as human beings, have a basic need to be respected in society. And it's not just about you're not sincere, blah, blah, blah. We are neurologically wired that way. That's just the way our nervous system works. And there are some people who, before they join the movement, love to be different, love to be exotic, wore exotic clothes. They have no problem. But most of us weren't like that. Most of us weren't. I didn't grow up that way. I didn't grow up with a natural desire to be really weird and freaky and exotic and body piercing or this or that. I didn't grow up that way. I'm not emotionally wired that way. And so I need to participate in the Hare Krishna movement, which is respectable in the world. I got to a point where I just got sick of walking down the street, having people stare at me and talk. I don't need that in my life. I don't want that in my life. I don't think it's healthy for me, emotionally. And there are some people who don't mind it. There are some people that, it's okay. But you see, here's the price you pay, in my view. I think that there's two ways it can be okay to be, like, very strange in society. There's two ways that can be okay. One way is, you're that kind of person. You just like, freaky is good. You like to be different. And we see, not just devotees, you go all over Europe, you'll find there's certain, normally young people, but there are certain people that just really like to be different. That's what they like. And there's another way it can be okay for you, and that is you just tune out the world. And that, I think, is the popular way of doing it among devotees. And that is you paint this very black picture of the world. Denmark is a terrible country. France is a terrible country. Germany is a terrible country. Spain is a terrible... Basically, every country I've gone to, that's what you hear from the local devotees, how terrible their country is. And therefore, it's just like, for example, during the Vietnam War, a very important part of the training of American soldiers was psychological. Because of the nature of the combat in the jungle, you had to often really kill people up close, got very close and personal. Like with, cutting people's throats with knives, all kinds of really nasty things. And therefore, to prevent the soldiers from becoming traumatized, because they were just guys who were working in gas stations or going to school or something, and next thing, and to turn them into killers. How do you turn just some average guy into a killer? And the way they would do this is, they would program them that the people you're killing, they're not people. These are not people. They're just, they called them geeks. That's where the word geek actually came from. They're not people. You're not killing a real person. And so, you can see that when you live in such a way that most people in your society think that you're strange, that is very difficult to live with emotionally. And the way people protect themselves from that is that you have to block out all those people who are thinking negatively. Otherwise, it's overwhelming. It's actually overwhelming to a normal human being to live in a place where there's like millions of people who have negative views of you. And the way you survive that is you separate yourself from those people. They're just, they're karmis in this case. They're degraded. They're this. They're that. Their opinions don't matter. And then this is the only opinion that matters, What my guru says, what the devotees say. But the price we pay, I believe the price we pay is that in order to protect ourselves psychologically from this massive negativity, because it's really out there. It doesn't mean people think we're evil. It doesn't mean that the people think we're the devil. They may just think they're kind of weird. So in order to protect yourself from that, you put up these walls, and then it becomes safe for you psychologically. The only problem is those walls separate us from the world that we're trying to save. And the result is, after years and years and years and years, who are we in society? I mean, Denmark, I won't comment. I don't know Denmark that well. But every place I've been, and certainly in the United States, it's obvious that we are basically irrelevant, insignificant. We don't matter. In America, for example, there's all kinds of burning issues involving religion and society, religion and education, religion and politics. And when Prabhupada was here, when those issues came up, we got phone calls People want to know, what's your view on it? What's the Hare Krishna view on this? No one ever calls us. No one calls us anymore, because we don't matter. Among scholars, and these are not demons, these are scholars that have nothing against the movement, we are listed as a more or less a failed movement. In the sense of a movement that, I mean, we still exist, basically as a movement in America to preach to the Indian diaspora. But in terms of a movement that had great ambitions, that had the ambition to change the world, that had ambition to become a major spiritual force, we failed. And we're listed as such, as a historical failure in that sense. Of course, when I say this, I get letters from different leaders saying you shouldn't use that word. But I think that, you know, if we just, unless we really open our eyes and see the truth, I don't see how we can make progress. So again, I have no position in ISKCON. I mean, I'm a sannyasi, so I guess that'll get you a free lunch everywhere. But, you know, I don't have any position in ISKCON. I'm not telling everyone, and, you know, in practical matters, manage this way, manage that way. I don't want anything. You know, I didn't come to Europe looking for disciples or positions or titles or money or anything. I simply think that we need to do some very serious thinking. Because Prabhupada made it very clear to me what he wanted. And what Prabhupada wanted is not happening. And I can either just go along with everybody else, don't make trouble, don't make waves. You know, everyone will like you, everyone will think you're great. You just give the regular class and just, you know, get your little check for 108 and get your free lunch and just go away and don't bother people. But I feel like we'd be betraying Prabhupada. And so if everyone in the world, even if everyone in the world, actually it's not happening, a lot of people like it, but how can I not do what I am completely convinced Prabhupada wants me to do, Prabhupada needs me to do? Try to restore this movement as a powerful, relevant, spiritual force in the Western world. So, I'm just trying to do this for Prabhupada. I really don't want anything else. Yes, you will raise your hand.
Yeah. I'm just thinking, Prabhupada introduced this exotic culture, you can say, way where, you know, Indian clothing and you make chapatis and all this, but didn't he do that for an important reason? Is it not important to, like, to have this culture, to like make a distinction from the rest of society? Is it not important to...
Okay, right. Okay, a few historical facts. Number one, database, you can look this up. Devotee asked Prabhupada, why do we have to dress like that? Prabhupada said, I never said you had to dress like that, it was your idea. That's in database. Number two, Prabhupada personally said to me, and I've noticed at ISKCON that once people become fixed in certain ideas, I can tell that Prabhupada personally told me something, it doesn't matter. It doesn't change anything. But in Honolulu, there was temple president, Sudama Swami, who passed away many years ago. And you remember Sudama Swami?
I never met him.
Anyway, he was actually went to my high school. So Sudama Swami was president of Honolulu. He left the temple. Prabhupada went there. It was kind of a disturbance. And I was there also. And someone said to Prabhupada, Sudama said he didn't want to wear Indian dress. And Prabhupada said, I don't care about that. He said, just be a gentleman. Prabhupada's fear was that we would have a relapse and become hippies. Prabhupada saw incredible indecency, you know, women, just real indecency. And Prabhupada was just trying to clean them up in the way he knew from his culture. Here's a direct quote from Prabhupada. We don't care about dress. Dress is a dead thing. We care about consciousness. Here's another direct quote from Prabhupada. Clothes have nothing to do with the soul. Here's another direct quote from Prabhupada. It does not matter how a guru dresses. I mean, wouldn't it be kind of a little silly at least to tell the world you're not your body, but you are your clothes? I mean, you don't think the world notices how silly that is? I mean, we're the only ones that don't see how silly that is. I understand that, and again, as far as Prabhupada, Yeah, Prabhupada, I mean, you know, Prabhupada definitely made some favorable comments about it, and he made many, many, many comments saying it's trivial, which is obvious. So, if someone needs that, if someone feels more Krishna conscious, if someone needs to dress a certain way in order to be fixed in bhakti yoga, yes, and you should dress that way. You know, save yourself first. But to tell the public that this is a basic principle of bhakti yoga, when Prabhupada says the opposite, Rupa Goswami says the opposite, Shastra says the opposite, Prabhupada kept emphasizing that what distinguishes us from other movements is that we actually have parampara. We actually have Shastra. Prabhupada quoted that verse he quoted Lord Chaitanya, Jari dako tare kaha Krishna padesh, amara gyai guru hai tare desh. Wherever you go, tell people Krishna's message, become a guru and save this land, tare desh. So Prabhupada quotes that in Veda Vyasa about 200 times. And when he says over and over and over and over again, is that it's not difficult to be a guru, you just repeat what Krishna said. So, if we give that up, okay, let me just finish that. You don't have to keep your hand in the air, things. So, if we give that up, if we give up what Prabhupada said distinguishes us from the other movements, we really want to give that up? To save what? A certain dress style? In order to save a certain dress style, we're going to give up that which distinguishes us from all other movements? For a dress style? And when Prabhupada himself says, clothes are a dead thing, clothes have nothing to do with the soul. So yes, if you join the Hare Krishna movement, frankly, oftentimes you're given a certain story. Prabhupada wants this, he doesn't want that. It's a nice little package. Until you actually start looking under the surface, and what did Prabhupada really say? And what's the real history of ISKCON? It's like when you're an undergraduate. If you're an undergraduate, I don't know what you call it in Denmark, like first 4 years, bachelor degree program. But it's interesting, when you're an undergraduate, what they call an undergraduate in America, you take these courses like introduction to, you know, sociology or history or Indology. You get these nice little package things. Yes, we know this, we know that, and they know everything. And then when you get to graduate school, well, you know this from Darwin. I was looking at one of your books today. Were you making that exact point, that when you look at the real facts, you find there's all kinds of problems, there's all kinds of uncertainties. You were attacking someone using the word function two different ways.
Okay.
Yeah. And so when, you know, if you get this nice little package, this is Vedic culture, you dress like this, you eat like that, you do this, you do that, it's very nice because you don't have to think, and thinking is not encouraged. You don't have to think, you just have this beautiful little picture of being better than everyone else in the world, which is, you know, very comforting. But then when you look under the surface, if you do start thinking and start looking more closely at what Prabhupada said, you find that it's a little different. And so what I want to do, what I'm trying to do basically, is saying, hey everybody, there's a whole other side of Prabhupada. There are all these other quotes from Prabhupada. And Prabhupada actually is giving us the freedom and flexibility we need to make this movement work in the West. I'm not trying to say, forget what Prabhupada said, this is my idea. I'm saying the opposite. Why don't we look at all of Prabhupada? Why don't we keep all of Prabhupada in the center of ISKCON? Why should we filter out half of what he said on these things? Or over half of what he said on these things? Just filter it out. So that, you know, if a devotee by nature happens to be conservative, then you just filter out everything Prabhupada said that doesn't fit that little picture. The real Prabhupada actually gave us everything we need to make this movement relevant and to start winning and to start becoming an important spiritual movement in Denmark, in Germany, in France, in Italy, in Spain, everywhere. Prabhupada gave us the ammunition we need. But you actually have people preaching against it. As if it's Maya. It comes from Prabhupada, but it's Maya somehow, because it doesn't fit a particular little picture. I'll give you an example. This is actually historically normal. This is what you would expect if you know the history of religions. I'll give you one example. In the 300s AD, in the 4th century AD, the Christian world was divided, really divided in half between two groups. One group was the Trinitarians, who believed in the Trinity doctrine. And the other group was, they were called Arians, because they followed a priest named Arius, who said that if you hear what Jesus actually said about himself, he makes it very clear he's not God. Whenever Jesus talks about himself and God, he always presents God as being greater than himself. And so for almost a century, there was this big debate going on that completely divided the Christian world. And eventually the Trinitarians won by a combination of preaching and, attacking their opponents, burning churches down. And because it was all, because there was the Eastern Roman Empire and the Western Roman Empire, there were two Christian groups, and so there were these four variables that just kept going around and around. At times the Western Empire supported the Trinitarians, at times they supported the Arians, at times the Eastern Empire supported one or the other, and so it was all mixed in with political power, military victories. If an Eastern Emperor fought a Western Emperor and won the battle, then whatever group he happened to favor would become the... So it was going around and around. And finally, by the end of the 4th century, I mean, obviously, from my view, it's a no-brainer. Obviously, we have to take seriously what Jesus says about himself. And Jesus always presents God as being greater than him. And Jesus, in fact, does not preach that I am fully man, fully God. That obviously he didn't preach that. And he wasn't accused of preaching that. So, my point is that by the end of the 4th century, it became a capital crime. That means a crime punished by death. To argue that when Jesus talks about himself, we should believe him. If you insisted that we should believe Jesus when he talks about himself, you were killed. Similarly, I can say things that Prabhupada said about himself over and over again about where he's infallible and what his limitations are, and some leaders will think I'm offensive. They do think I'm offensive for basically repeating what Prabhupada said about himself. So again, I want to keep the real Prabhupada in the center. I don't believe that we should understand everything through Prabhupada's teachings except Prabhupada. Apparently, some people want to take Prabhupada and put him outside his own teachings. So you understand the universe, God, the soul, everything through Prabhupada's teachings. But Prabhupada stands outside his teachings. And if Prabhupada over and over again describes his own limitations, for example, saying a pure devotee, Prabhupada's a pure devotee, but a pure devotee is not materially infallible or omniscient. Or Prabhupada saying, for example, that there are variable details, and many of Prabhupada's statements were variable details. Another point, actually to answer your question I wanted to make, the other point is that when Prabhupada was here, it worked. I mean, it didn't work with older people, they despised us, but in terms of, because young people and old people just, they were really alienated, but it was working. The movement was growing, we were powerful, we were relevant, it was working. And now it's not. And if you study Prabhupada's life, every time in Prabhupada's life that a particular tactic didn't work, he changed it. So for you to say, or for anyone to say, that Prabhupada, for example, would visit his American temples and find they were no longer American temples, and he wouldn't change anything, what right do you have to say that? Throughout Prabhupada's life, whenever something didn't work, he made an adjustment. So what right does anyone have to say what Prabhupada would say if he came now? I sat at Prabhupada's feet so many times when Prabhupada, again, press conferences, he was telling the world, he pointed to us sitting there. He said, these are American boys and girls. I did not import them from India. It was working. Now if he came to the temple, he'd have to say the opposite. So who presumes to say that if Prabhupada came back to America, And he would hardly recognize his temples, first of all. He would hardly recognize them. Everything utterly transformed. Prabhupada used to say that the churches are empty, our temples are full. Now the churches are full, and our temples are empty of Westerners. And Prabhupada wouldn't do anything? He wouldn't adjust anything? Who can say that? With what authority can someone say that? So it's not that some people just want to follow Prabhupada and some people want to change. No, I'm following Prabhupada, but other instructions that Prabhupada gave, and instructions which clearly need to be mobilized, they need to be activated, because in the Western world, we're not winning the game. It's like a coach, you know, we're losing the game, no, do the same thing. It's like, you know, when Brazil played Germany in the World Cup. Anyone know about that? None of you know about
it? We try to not know about it.
What's it?
We try to not know about it.
Oh. Anyway, again...
I know the loss. Yeah, I know the loss.
Recreation, moderation. Didn't cause me to fall down. So, but what I'm saying is the team is losing. And the coach says, don't change anything. Just keep doing the same thing. And they keep losing. Don't change anything. That strategy is actually in every textbook ever written on business administration, how to manage corporations or organizations. They will tell you that's the sign that you are in deep trouble. That it's not working, you're not growing, but you have a culture within the corporation, don't criticize, just do the same thing. That is the classic response of a corporation that's not making it. So, again, you may agree with me, you may not agree with me, but we have to think about these things. And frankly, if the GBC or anyone else comes up with a better plan, I will be eternally grateful. Because it's not my first choice for my life to go everywhere and make arguments and bother people. You know, it's not actually the first choice, my first choice. I'd rather write books. So if someone has a better plan, I'll be eternally grateful, and I'll be very happy to defer to your plan. Where's the better plan? If you do something for over a third of a century and it doesn't work, and then you say, okay, the plan is, let's do the same thing. I don't consider that a plan. So if someone has a better plan based on Prabhupada's instructions and based on social science, based on history. In other words, a serious, intelligent plan has been researched. Come up with it and I'll join your thing. But where's the plan? Based on history, based on social science, based on Prabhupada. Yes.
I was wondering about two things.
Yes.
First of all, you mentioned yesterday that in ISKCON, in like you referred to it as golden age in the beginning, but it was like spiritual.
For the time. West.
Yeah.
For the West.
So I was just thinking about one thing that you mentioned, and how to implement it, like where I am in the Brahmachari ashram. For example, this I try to keep like some distance from like
the women.
Yeah, of course. Like, especially when young women come, and like I meet them on the street, and I distribute books to them, and then we exchange. And then in the temple, I try to be a little more. Like,
well, that's natural. At the same time, the real strategy for self-control is to respect women, because lust. I mean, in terms of psychology, serious studies of it. Lust means that a person wants to lord it over a woman, say in the case of a man being lusty. And so that's why we find that, I'm not accusing you of this, of course, but that's why we find that brahmacharis, and there have been such brahmacharis who are sannyasis, who sort of cultivate a low opinion of women, they're the ones that tend to fall down, you know, the soonest. Because actually, putting women down, thinking badly of women, there's a very thin line between that and sexually exploiting a woman. Because both of them are based on lording it over, both of them are based on thinking yourself better and, you know, subjugating them. And actually, it's exploitation of women, because in other words, rather than respecting a person, I will, in my mind, think badly of that person for my spiritual safety. So whenever you put someone else down for your happiness, that's called exploitation. And that's why, frankly, Krishna talks about this. Krishna talks about raga dvesha, being attached to something or despising it, hating it. They're just two sides of the same coin. So thinking badly of women and sexually exploiting women are just two sides of the same mental process. I'm not saying you're doing that. But if you need to keep a distance for your spiritual life, then you should do so. I mean, everyone has a right to save themselves.
This was not so much about thinking bad of women. I just, like, in Western society, there's, like, a very loose interaction between men and women, and the way we're brought up in the schools and chit-chat and this and that. So I'm just, like...
No, I understand. I mean, yes, actually everywhere in the world. I mean, in any other country or India, I mean, you know, there are ways that men and women seduce each other. And if it's a chaste culture, then... Even in India today, frankly, if you go to, say you're preaching at a university in India, I mean, the women aren't dressed in saris, believe me, most of them. So again, it's true the West is certainly still, I mean, India is becoming, if you look at Bollywood, it gets very erotic. I mean, I've seen very erotic shows at ISKCON Rathiyatras done by Bollywood people. I mean, there was one in Australia that amazed me. I mean, the women were thrusting out the more famous parts of their body. It was erotic. It was extremely erotic. And yet, it was okay in front of Lord Jagannath because it was Indian. So, I think that, I mean, we have, in ISKCON, I'm not criticizing you, but it's just a very deeply rooted habit to always put down the West. And... you can't simultaneously insult people and attract them unless you're attracting someone with a very weird psychology that likes to be abused. I mean, some people like to be abused, so you will attract some people, but probably not the ones you want. I mean, everyone has a right. Everyone has a right to do what they have to do to save themselves. We should just do what we need to do in a way that doesn't offend other people. Yes.
And then the other thing, you mentioned this about like change of strategy when something doesn't seem to work. So what is your position on like food distribution, outdoor hiding and prasada distribution?
Yeah, just do all three. At the right time, at the right place, in the right manner. That's what we do. I mean, that's our mission, to teach people, to teach the world to chant Hare Krishna. And to give them knowledge. I think we should really try to give people books that they're likely to understand and be able to read. I don't think we can spread the movement just by having people touch sacred books or buy books that they don't read. I mean, we know that if someone just has Prabhupada's book in their home, it's purifying. But Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 1728, that any religious activity performed without faith gives very little result. So we should, and Prabhupada himself asked me to do that. I mean, Prabhupada himself wrote me a letter and said, read my books and then explain them in your own words. So the goal is to bring people to Prabhupada. We're not changing the goal. I don't have the purity to save the world. I just work here. Prabhupada is the one that actually has the purity and the potency to sustain a worldwide Krishna consciousness movement. So the goal is to bring people to Prabhupada. The question is, we have to be intelligent about how to get them there. And so, you know, the fact that, let's say, you give out a particular book by Prabhupada doesn't mean that you're bringing someone to Prabhupada. We know in the old days in the airports that most, you know, at least in L.A., most of the huge percentage of the books were thrown away. So, I'm very practical. We have to bring people to Prabhupada, but you've got to do it. You actually have to do that. If you give someone a book that they don't read or can't understand, you didn't bring someone to Prabhupada. So I think if we can somehow or other, whatever, it could be, you know, Prabhupada's books, but somehow or other bring them to Prabhupada and actually get them there. As far as Harinam, yes, if we only took music as seriously as we took food. Because we see devotees all around the world have restaurants, like Govinda's restaurants. And what restaurant can survive if the owner says, I don't care what people want to eat, this is what I want, this is what I want to cook. That's a great way to go out of business very quickly. If you have a prasadam restaurant, it's prasadam, it's spiritual. But you don't cook what you want to cook. You cook what people want to eat and what they're going to buy. So when we do Harinam, it's not about us. We're already saved. You know, we can be very humble and I'm the most fallen and blah, blah, blah. But the real fact is, if you're serving Prabhupada, you're saved. Now, a little while from now, whatever. It's about them, not about us. So why not make music that they actually want to hear, that they actually like? It's like a restaurant. What's the difference? You know, holy name, prasadam, they're all spiritual. Why not approach Harinam the way we approach Govinda's restaurant? Cook what people want to eat, not what you want to cook. And I think if we had that attitude, I mean, there are many devotee musicians, obviously, there are many different things, but if we went out on the street, if we took it seriously, if devotees became great musicians, if devotees really took music, it's just like if you cook for the deities, you take cooking seriously. So if you're going out to the public and you're making music, you should take it very seriously. Don't just go and bang, bang, bang on a drum. You know, you may think it's ecstatic to bang on a drum, but other people may not. And so why don't we care about people? How are they going to care about us if we don't care about them? You see, we have a very good pseudo-philosophical excuse not to care about people, because they're going to be involuntarily purified. They're going to be automatically purified, even though Rupa Goswami says that will cause you to fall down if you think that way. Niyama Agraha. So, you know, this idea they'll be automatically purified as frees us from any moral obligation to care about them. We don't care if they like the music or not. We don't care if our dress seems strange to them. We actually don't care. Because it's irrelevant. It's irrelevant. Their feelings, you know, we're trying to attract the public, and there's this very powerful conviction among the devotees that the feelings of non-devotees don't matter. Their feelings don't matter. They're too stupid to have any useful feelings, and so we just go out there and involuntarily purify them. You know, that contempt, the contempt toward the public, they reciprocate. We have contempt for them, and guess what they have for us? We don't care about their feelings, and guess what? They don't care about ours. To me, a real Vaishnava, you can't tell a real Vaishnava what's his dress style. I mean, I joined the Hare Krishna movement to get away from that. I mean, that's not, we joined the movement to find a real spiritual science, not to find a bunch of silliness where you are your clothes. In my opinion. And so I care about the people. I'm saved, not because I'm a great devotee, but because Prabhupada's very merciful. You know, I chant my rounds, I follow the principles, I try to serve, and so, you know, whether it's today or tomorrow or the next day, basically we're all saved by Prabhupada's mercy. It's not about us. It's about them. It's about the people who are not saved. And it's about actually being merciful and doing every, you know, moving heaven and earth, doing everything necessary to help these people. And if we can do something, if we look at the list, if we look at Rupa Goswami's list, and we find something's not on the list of fundamental principles, and therefore, it's a detail. And if by making some little adjustment, we can make it a little easier for the people of Denmark to come to Prabhupada, why aren't we doing that? Maybe you can find a good reason. I can't. If I could make it just a little easier, or even much easier, for the poor, as you said, they're all suffering, even if they're the happiest, they're still suffering. If we can make it a little easier or much easier for these fallen souls to find shelter with Prabhupada, why wouldn't I do that? Why in the world wouldn't I do that if I really care about people? But again, people think we're strange. We protect ourselves psychologically by tuning them out. We take a principle of Agyata Sukriti, we blow it up beyond anything found in Shastra. Krishna directly says a religious activity, including sacrifice, like Sankirtan, a religious activity performed without faith, and if you don't know about it, you can't believe in it, performed without faith has very little result. We have ignored what Krishna says. We have ignored Rupa Goswami's statement that if you think the results of bhakti are automatic. We ignore what Prabhupada told Giriraj just a few days before he left, that it is not enough just to chant Hare Krishna and follow the principles. You must be intelligent. We ignore all of that. And we, because, you know, and we just go out there and they'll be liberated involuntarily. Their feelings don't matter, their taste doesn't matter, their preference don't matter. And if I say it do, then the answer is no, there's a bunch of meat-eating, evil, demonic, blah, blah, blah. Because emotionally, we can't afford to care about them, because if we do, we're going to be devastated by this massive negativity coming from hundreds of millions of people in the Western world. So we have to keep them in that box of basically stupid, degraded karmis whose opinions and feelings don't matter. It's an impasse. You know, it's like a soccer game where no one can score. So, forgive me if I've offended anyone or anything, but there's a lot at stake, the world's at stake. This is not, you know, maybe I should be more polite, maybe I should be more something or other, or less something. But, you know, we're talking about the fate of the world. I mean, haven't you ever seen a Bruce Willis movie? I guess you haven't. Anyway, Bruce Willis preached Prabhupada's Gita. We're talking about the fate of the world. I mean, haven't you seen those movies where the world's going to end and some hero is frantically trying to save the world before it blows up? And that's what we're talking about. The world, we're talking about saving the planet. It's not just about, you know, sitting around and tuning your harmonium. We're talking about saving the planet and desperately trying to find a way to make people comfortable with us, to make it easier for them. That's what Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, for God's sake. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that Namashaya Kori Jatane Tumi Takana Apana Kaje, remain in your social position. It's not the duty of this movement to drag people out of their culture, to drag people out. You know, that was the early days. We joined the movement when people were very radical, young people. They left their homes, they left their families, they left school, they went out to some utopian community. And that became the model for ISKCON. That a real devotee kind of, you know, you give up everything and you join. That's not normal in history. That was a special time. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, you stay in your position. If you are Danish, you remain Danish. But you add Krishna. That's the wrong message in my view. Give up everything which is, you know, Danish and accept everything that's Indian. That's the wrong message. The message is, add Krishna to your life. Accept Prabhupada as your teacher. That's the message. You know, be a respectable person. We're not going to put you through this emotional torture of having all your friends and family think you're crazy. I talked to one of the senior Prabhupada disciples in Germany. He's very well known. I won't mention it, but I talked to him. And he had a good job. He was respected. Everyone liked him. One day they saw him out in Harinam, you know, and that was it.
Game over. That was it. Everyone liked him. Everyone respected him. It was over. They saw him once. And yet you have leaders going around saying, no, everyone loves us. Everyone likes it. And there's so many, I mean, there are innumerable stories like this. There are innumerable stories. So, I am just trying to do this for Prabhupada. If everyone, whatever anyone thinks of me, it's for Prabhupada. I'd rather have Prabhupada please and everyone else think I'm a jerk. Actually, maybe I am a jerk, but I'm still trying to do this for Prabhupada. It reminds me of this joke. In America, there's these lawyer jokes. Do you ever have lawyer jokes in Denmark? In America, they had all these jokes about lawyers. Everyone hated lawyers.
There's so many lawyers. There's more lawyers in America, than the rest of the world put together.
My God. So what's other, this guy's walking down the street saying, lawyers are jerks. Lawyers are jerks. And so a man comes up and says, I find your remarks very offensive. So the man said, are you a lawyer? He said, no, I'm a jerk. Anyway, I guess we'll end here. So, thank you all very much for your patience. And again, I'm not trying to interfere with anything you do here in Denmark. You have to figure out the details. All I'm saying is that we have to find a way to make Prabhupada's mission successful in this country. We have to be a relevant, important spiritual movement in this country. And you have to figure out the way to do it. And I leave that to you. Prabhupada ki jai.